Welcome back to Mound Money. On the phone with us now is Jason Ware. He is the Chief Investment Officer at Albion Financial Group. Just another disclosure, that's the firm that I work with. So Jason's desk and my desk are right next to each other. Jason's regularly interviewed on CNBC, Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and other groups like that. Jason, welcome to KPCW's Mound Money.
Good morning, Doug. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, Jason, June's been a very bumpy month. At the beginning of this month, people were very concerned about the market. We had some very big down weeks, but it's ending on a really strong note. It's had a couple strong weeks. The last 2 weeks have been strong. Why has this month been particularly volatile, do you think?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and it's on the forefront of investors' minds, to be sure. And, you know, our view has been that, you know, what the Trump administration taketh away in terms of concerns over trade with China, Jerome Powell and the Fed have giveth back. And what we've seen over the past couple of weeks is a Fed that is clearly more dovish in terms of their policy position on monetary policy, and that's been supportive to stocks over the past couple of weeks, as you've noted. Certainly, this idea that if trade were to go sideways, even more so than it already has, that the Fed might step in with a rate cut or two has lent support to the stock market. So I think that's probably the best way to think about the past few weeks.
And, you know, one of the things we talk about at work is, you know, the fundamentals, the foundation of the economy, the main pillars that support and drive the stock market. Have those changed much in the last month?
Yeah, so that's the central and most important question that investors can ask themselves. You know, certainly, you know, May was a really rough month in the stock market. I think it was the worst month in the market since 2010. Here in June, over the past couple of weeks, as we've noted, the market has strengthened again, and now we have the best month, I think, since 1955. So the stock market is volatile. That's the nature of the stock market. It can whip you in one direction and then go the other direction completely the next month. So to try to look through the noise, which is the volatility, and find the signal, we like to pay attention to what you mentioned, which were the underlying four pillars of the economy. And those are, how's the economy doing? How are corporate earnings doing? We can check the box there. Both of them continue to grow, continue to expand. Things look fairly healthy as far as the economy is concerned. Interest rates are low. In fact, they're lower still. Earlier this year, rates were on the 10-year somewhere north of 2.7%. Now we're down around 2.1%. Lower interest rates are typically good for both the economy and the stock market. And then meanwhile, inflation is running below the Fed's 2% target, and that's typically supportive to stock prices as well. So when we look at the foundation and the fundamentals, things continue to be encouraging.
So why did we have that volatility? Why was May so bad, and what made June so much better?
Yeah, so I think, you know, going back to what I mentioned a moment ago, it was May that the trade talks with China began to fall apart, and we started getting reports that maybe we're going back to square one. You know, after 18 months of uncertainty around trade with the two largest economic powers in the world, there seemed to be progress in the spring. And, you know, March and April, we were actually getting close to a deal, it seemed. Now, of course, nobody knows except for those inside the administration, but the market was getting a sense that things were potentially wrapping up. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it was the first week of May. You might recall that we hit a market high on April 30th, and then that first week of May was quite a sell-off in the market. And that continued through May, as it turned out that things were getting pretty shaky on the trade front. So that's what happened in May. That continued into the first part of June, and then the stock market kind of pivoted to what Jerome Powell and the Fed were saying, and what they were saying is that, you know, we stand here basically ready to support the economy if needed.
So Jason, we talked about the pillars, the foundations that your research is based on, your outlook is based on. One of the items that's getting a lot of talk in the press right now is the inverted yield curve. We're going to have a guest next week. We're going to do a deep dive on that. But a lot of people believe that it is a clairvoyant tool. What's your thoughts on the inverted yield curve? And first off, what is it, and are we inverted now or are we not? And is it clairvoyant, or should people be maybe a little skeptical?
Sure. So the yield curve is just essentially the different parts of the Treasury maturity and what interest is being paid at those various levels. So for like the shortest, you know, 90-day or 3-month Treasury bill, the interest rate is X, and then the longest dated, the 30-year Treasury bond, the interest rate is Y. And whether that's positively sloped, that is, the longer dated pays more than the shorter dated, and if it's inverted, it's the other way around. Yeah. So what the market's currently saying is that the basically the 30-day Treasury bill is inverted relative to the 10-year Treasury bond. That's the one part of the curve, and in fact, I think it goes through the belly of the curve to about the 7-year that is slightly inverted. And I want to emphasize slightly, where it's 10 to 15 basis points. There are those in the market that are looking at that. There are several economists, including those at the San Francisco Fed, that believe that the 30-day Treasury bill versus the 10-year bond, 10-year Treasury bond, signals that maybe there's economic problems ahead. There's certainly some research to suggest there may be truth to that. I think it's important to remember that the yield curve, measuring the yield curve, is more art than it is science, because if you look at the 2-year bond versus the 10-year Treasury bond, right now we're still positively sloped, which suggests that the economy is doing fine. So it depends on the part of the yield curve one chooses to look at. It also depends on the reasons why the yield curve may be inverting. I think there's certainly an argument to be made that the market is saying that the Fed went a little bit too far in raising interest rates last year, and that that's why that first part of the yield curve I mentioned is inverted. It's not so much an economic signal as it is a reflection of the Fed being a little bit too tight relative to economic conditions, and therefore might be why also the Fed is looking to potentially ease to reset the yield curve back to a more healthy level. So there's a couple of schools of thought there.
So Jason, excuse me, I was telling Doug before our meeting, before we met for the show, that you and Doug are so good at this stuff, and frankly, I am not. So I have a question about the inverted yield curve. What's the history of this theory? And can you take us back to a specific time in our country where the inverted yield curve theory played out?
So that's a really great question, and the yield curve has historically been a really strong predictor of where the economy goes over the next 7 months to 3 years. And that's another really important element to remember when thinking about the yield curve, is that it's done a great job predicting whether the economy is growing or slowing down or potentially going into recession, but it does so with a lead time. There's typically, you know, several months up to, like I said, 3 years. So it's not a science, again, in terms of, oh, the economy is going into recession tomorrow. It's really just a signal that it could go into recession at some point down the road. Now, if you look back over the last 60, 70 years of data, the yield curve has a really good track record of predicting economic contractions. I believe in 9 of the last 9 recessions, the 2-year bond and the 10-year bond having an inversion in that part of the curve has predicted an economic contraction by an average of about 18 months.
Oh, wow.
So it has a really good track record, and that's why people pay attention to it so closely, because it's one of those few economic indicators that are worth paying attention to. Now, that said, there have been a couple of false signals. In 1966, there was a false signal, and then I believe in the early 1970s, there was a false signal. So it doesn't always work, but it typically does, and that's why it gets so much attention paid to it.
Okay, well, let's move on, because we do have a guest that we're going to devote 15, 20 minutes to, and we're going to really dig deep into that. Our third co-host, Renee, Roger Goldman, mm-hmm. Just texted me and reminded me that we've got a guest coming in. And apparently our guest next week is the person that invented the theory.
Yeah.
So you definitely want to tune in next week to Mound Money. Jason, I like talking about these foundational aspects. I think they're helpful for people that are investing on their own, in thinking through what is foundational to you, what is foundational to Albion, it might be something that they want to consider. You know, another one of your foundational tenets, in fact, you gave a presentation on this a couple months ago, is the difference and the importance between timing the market, trying to decide when to get in and when to get out of the market, versus time in the market. Can you spend a few minutes talking to us about why that's important?
Yeah. So I think it's one of the things about investing is that it's pretty sexy to watch the market on a daily, weekly, and monthly basis. You know, the Dow was up this much or the Dow was down that much. That captures the average person's attention, and understandably so. It's one of those things that is we feel like is important that we need to be up on all the time. What does that say about the economy? What does that say about maybe my job prospects if the economy is softening or potentially going into troublesome waters? So I understand why that matters to people. And we're also connected now, right, with social media and with, you know, an Apple Watch. We can get updates to our portfolio and to what's happening in the market. But the truth is that paying attention to those short-term wiggles of the market ends up hurting the average investor more than it helps them. So that's why we go back to that saying that, you know, time in the market matters more than timing the market. Because the truth is, even professionals, most professionals cannot time the market consistently over time. People get lucky. There are instances where, you know, you feel like things are kind of, okay, there's storm clouds building and we need to move out of stocks and move to cash. And you might get that right, you know, occasionally. But the truth is, over time, you're unlikely to be able to do that consistently. And again, even professionals have a hard time doing that. So if you were to avoid that, that intuition and that impulse to want to move your money out of equities to try to time when things get bad, if you look at the bigger picture and you look at a long-run chart of the stock market, you see that consistently it goes from bottom left to upper right. And that's what investors really want to focus on, is that over long periods of time, the stock market typically does really well. And I want to share a couple of statistics with your listeners that I think are really important. If you look at, in any given year, the market is likely to be up 73 to 74% of the time. However, on any given day, it's about 53% of the time. So in other words, if you were to look at your portfolio every day, you have almost a coin toss odds in terms of whether or not your stocks are going to be up or down. But if you look at it once a year, you have about a 74% chance of seeing your stocks higher. Looking at it on a 10-year basis, it's about an 89% chance that on a real return, your stocks are going to be higher. Going 20 and 30 years out, it's 100%. So that really underscores statistically the value of long-term thinking and the value of taking that long-term perspective. And of course, we all know that over time, the stock market, the diversified portfolio of stocks, returns somewhere between 7 and 10%. That's really what you want to be focused on as a long-term investor, and ignoring those short-term wiggles, which really can cause stress and they can cause investors to make the wrong decision at the wrong time. So managing your behavior is really important. And that's a way to think about why that matters.
So when you say over time, 7 to 10%, how long is that period of time?
Well, so, you know, I mean, that's an average annual return. You can go back 140 years and see that it's roughly 7 to 10%. You can go back 30 years and see it's roughly 7 to 10%. I think one of the most impressive statistics in the stock market is the rolling 20-year and rolling 30-year returns. And I wish I had the ability to put a chart up for your viewers. And you can see that as you roll those periods, and there's a lot of different data points within there, that the average return is going to be somewhere between the numbers that I cited. And you can slice that out in decades. You can slice that out over generations. But it's almost always the same. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that's going to be the case going forward. You know, I'm not making any predictions here. But for the average long-term experience, that's what the equity market has given long-term investors. And it's also important to note that in any given year, that's not typically what we get. So the dispersion of returns is a lot more volatile, which is what makes it kind of challenging. But smoothing that out over the long term, that's what long-term investors can expect.
Jason, let me add to that just a couple data points. So what makes it hard for people to stay the course, right? We all know that over a long period of time, we're likely there. But boy, when the market's down, it's really scary. And there's really good reasons why the market's down. And it causes people to really stress. A data point that might be helpful for our listeners is two-thirds of corrections are back to where they started 30 days later. And we just saw that play out. Jason just mentioned about how terrible May was. June got off to a horrible start, but we're fully recovered from that and positive from there. So two-thirds in 1 month, and 80% of corrections are corrected in 3 months. So I think what's important is have a game plan. If you feel like you have to make a change, it's not all or nothing. Think of it as a tweak, and have a game plan to get back in in case you're wrong.
I guess the one thing, though, that seems shaky to investors right now, and Jason and Doug, chime in on this, please. We are sort of in a new world, it seems. Whether you like it or don't like it, this administration does things vastly differently than any other administration before.
Diplomatically put, thank you.
So how do you guys manage your investors' emotions? And does it make you guys feel like maybe there are new rules in place?
Jason, both you and I are fans of what we call behavioral economics,
which
speaks to Renee's question. Tell our audience what behavioral economics is and why it's important to their long-term success.
So at the core of behavioral economics is this idea that we all have inherent psychological biases, right? And that those biases, and everybody does. This is not directed at any one group or any one individual. Professionals and retail investors alike all are subject to these biases. And what's important is to recognize that if you have them, and if you know you have them, then you can make the appropriate changes to your behavior when you need it most. So as Doug was mentioning, you know, when the market's volatile and you feel stressful, and you know it's about making incremental changes to the portfolio as opposed to wholesale in or wholesale out. If you understand yourself, it's like a good dose of investor know thyself. If you understand yourself, you understand your temperament, if you understand what you know you're likely to do in under different conditions and circumstances, then I think you're more likely to be able to recognize that and adjust your behavior accordingly to make sure you don't make the wrong decision at the wrong time. So that's really at the core of behavioral economics, is this understanding of knowing yourself and knowing what you're likely to do. So if you can adjust for that, you're more likely to make better decisions over the long term. And that's really what it's about, is making a series of good decisions over time to impact the ultimate outcome of your portfolio. So that's really at the core of it.
Well, I think I know myself, but I don't know Donald Trump, and that's what scares me. I don't know what's going to happen, and it just feels different. And to me, it feels different, but does it feel different to you, Jason? Are you looking at this administration and things that are happening and say, wow, I've never seen that before, and maybe I need to adjust how I advise my clients as a result?
It certainly feels different. There's no doubt about that. This is an unconventional, unorthodox administration, to be sure. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, over the long term, and I hate to sound like a broken record going back to long term, but the truth is that the individual that occupies 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is typically not that consequential to stocks over the long term. There are going to be perhaps more volatility because of uncertainties like trade war with China, which is not something that any of us would have expected, you know, 3, 5, 10 years ago, right? That was just everyone agreed. Economists on the left and the right agreed that protectionism is bad, globalization is good, and we want free trade. So nobody would have predicted that we would be here. But the truth is that despite the fact that this is all concerning and it's something that people are paying close attention to, our view is that if you look down the road 5 years and 10 years, which can be very hard in the moment, we recognize that. But if you look back over 5 and 10 years from now to where we are today, this will probably be a speed bump, on the road for America, is the way to think about it. If you look at a long-term chart of the stock market, there are several, and I have this great image I like to do in my presentations, and again, I wish I could share this with your viewers, but there are points all along the way over the last 70 years post-World War II where you can insert an event, a data point, you know, assassinations of presidents, you know, resignations of presidents, recessions, you name it. In fact, there was a point in the 1960s where North Korea had, taken over a U.S. submarine. I mean, can you imagine if that happened today, what the market reaction would be? And yet, if you look back over 40, 50, 60 years, they're just little tiny blips on the chart. And I think that's probably what we're dealing with here. So while unorthodox and uncomfortable, I think you got to keep that long-term perspective in mind.
So, Jason, going back to current events, there's a meeting coming up in a few days with President Xi and President Trump. Are there things that investors should be looking for? Is that something they should be concerned with? What's your thoughts on the importance and the impact on the stock market and the economy on this upcoming meeting?
Yeah. So what Doug's referring to is the G20 later this week, and the reports are at this time that President Trump and President Xi are going to meet. They're going to discuss the trade war and hopefully get things back on the right course. I think it would be best to think about this meeting as a stepping stone as opposed to an event where we're going to see headlines the next day over the weekend saying that China and the U.S., kumbaya, they've resolved the trade war. I don't expect that's going to happen. But what we can hope for as investors is that they reset the tone, which, like we mentioned in May and early June, had just been completely destroyed and back to square one. If they can get us back on a positive path and the discourse looks like it's getting better, not worse, and things are improving, then I think that'll be encouraging to investors. It'll be encouraging to everyone involved. And the truth is, with regards to international trade and trade with China, we're all interested parties. Everybody from, business leaders to investors, all the way to consumers. So this matters. It's a matter of great importance, and I think it's something that we'll all be watching for, and hopefully seeing things going down the right path after G20.
Jason, we need to wrap. We've got time for one last question. You mentioned earlier the importance of making good decisions when it comes to your investments. I would argue that should be every investor's goal. If you can make a series of good decisions, they're not all going to work out, but overall, I think you're going to be in a much better position if that is your goal, as opposed to trying to figure out what the market's going to do today, tomorrow, a week from now, even a month from
right.
now. From your standpoint, Jason, you've met with hundreds of clients. Give us another foundational piece of advice as we leave. What would your advice to people to help them be more likely to succeed over the long term?
So I like to use statistics as a way of trying to contextualize long-term investing. And, it's easy to get caught up in the noise. And I'll share this with your listeners. So today is the 1,141st all-time high for the stock market since World War II. And it's really easy. I think you mentioned earlier, Doug, and it was a beautiful point, spot on, that, the market always feels uncomfortable. When it's down, it feels like it's going to be down forever. And when we're at record highs, we feel like the precipice is upon us and we're going to go off the edge somewhere. And yet, the truth is, if you look back over market history, the market is typically at or near all-time highs. I mean, that's an enduring feature of a market that goes from the bottom left of the chart to the top right. And this is the, like I said, 1,141st all-time high since World War II. So when you hear folks saying, well, we're at record highs, maybe you should think about going to cash, or maybe you should get more defensive. The truth is that, as Ben Graham said, to be an investor, you have to be a believer in a better tomorrow. And it's not always going to be easy. But over the long term, when you string those better tomorrows together, what we get is prosperity, rising prosperity. What we get is progress. And the market celebrates that as a reflection of American progress. So I think if you think about it in those terms, and you turn off your phone, and you turn off your TV a little bit more, and you pay a little bit less attention to the wiggles in your portfolio, and you think about it through that big picture lens, I think that's a really important way for investors to take a step back and to breathe and to not have to take on the stress and the weight of things that are happening in the now, because the truth is, in 5, 10, 20 years, it's not going to matter much. And I think, as Warren Buffett says, the prosperity of the American economy endures and it continues to go up, and over the long term the news will be good. That's one of his sayings that I love the most, and I agree with that.
Well, here is to believing in a better tomorrow. Here is to optimism, and most importantly, here is to our 1,142nd high. Jason, thank you very much
Indeed.
For joining us this morning.
Thanks, Jason.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest this morning has been Jason Ware. He is the Chief Investment Officer at Albion Financial Group. Stay tuned to KPCW. Mountain Money will return in a moment.
This is Chris Wissner, store manager of Jan's, a longtime supporter of KPCW. Jan's guides fly fishing excursions to local waters and private ranches. Our fly shop is stocked with the gear you need, and our guides are ready to take you to the river. Serving Park City for over 30 years, Jan's Mountain Recreation Experts. 649-4949 or jans.com.
Hi, I'm Tony Tyler with Columbus Pacific Development. We're a proud sponsor of Mountain Money programming on KPCW. Columbus Pacific Development is a local Park City company with offices in Canyons Village. We're dedicated to bringing residential, hospitality, and commercial projects to Park City, including the Kimball on Main, Apex, and Viridian Residences.
Free Mountain Town music concerts from Snow Park Amphitheater are back, and KPCW will once again broadcast each show live. Listen in on 91.7, 88.1, or 91.9 as KPCW shares live summer music with a different band each week, every Wednesday evening, starting at 6 p.m. Thanks to Grand Valley Bank, Sundance Institute, and Wyndham Vacation Rentals in Park City. KPCW, where you can listen like a local.
And this is Mountain Money on KPCW Radio. I'm Renee Bodley-Miller here in studio with my co-host Doug Wells, our producer Bob Hendricks, and our next guest. Happy to introduce you to Jill Schroyer. She's with Expedition HR. Jill offers 15 years of HR experience in hospitality, technology, and health science industries. I bet you can handle more than that, too. She also helps managers navigate through the complex HR terrain. Jill, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks so much. Excited to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and your company.
Great, thanks. So my company is Expedition HR, as you mentioned. I focus on HR consulting with small startup or medium-sized companies, as well as offering career coaching. So my model essentially, kind of distilled down, is either working with a company to help them just with their high-level HR questions, concerns, or helping them facilitate kind of an HR administrative person, which can take care of the day-to-day, and I'm support for the higher level, personally, or just kind of on demand, as needed. Whenever something comes up, if they need help, I'm there.
So, Jill, you surprised me a little bit when you mentioned the career coaching. But it makes a ton of sense, because so often that's where managers stumble, particularly when somebody's been an individual contributor and now they're moving into managing the team. What are some of the common pitfalls that you see, and how do you help coach them beyond those pitfalls?
Fantastic. I love the question. So just to clarify too, currently I offer career coaching within companies, but also on an individual level outside of companies. But to address your question, that is the most common thing I see, is individuals are star performers and they are offered a promotion with really no option not to take the promotion into a managerial role. And so when that's expressed to me, I like to kind of take it back to asking the right questions as to what are their interests, just like I do on an individual level with career coaching. What do they love about their individual contributor role, and how could we take some of those skills and potentially make it work for that management role as well? And I offer management trainings to really coach up on those pieces, just even something as simple as listening and communication. It's amazing what skills people lack even in those basic areas.
Can I add a little bit to this?
So, sure.
You know, the challenge with star performers is they're really self-managed, right? And so they've really never seen a manager manage, because they've self-managed themselves. And I'll share an experience that I had. So I was an individual contributor, very much the situation, got this promotion, couldn't turn it down. And there was no training. From one day I was an individual contributor, the next day I was in charge of a group of 20 people with absolutely zero training. And I stumbled so badly. It was awful. The company actually hired me, a career coach. So for people that are managing teams now and they're promoting somebody, what can they do proactively before that promotion to that individual to help give that person the foundation that they needed?
I love that, and thanks for sharing your experience. That it's unfortunate how often that happens. So I kind of back up a little bit to just asking them the question, does it even interest you to manage people? You're doing so great in your role. And if a lot of people say, well, I'm not sure, I've never done it before. Helping them even just have a 30-minute conversation outlining, here's how your responsibilities would change from what they are now. And first of all and foremost, giving them the option. Now, with that said, sometimes it will lead into a bit of a difficult conversation, as far as there might not be the individual contributor role that they did so well at. They might need them to manage. but hopefully I'm addressing the question okay. In that case, saying, we'd really like you to try this. We know it's a stretch. If this is of interest to you, going to that next step of ticking through the management kind of core pieces that would make you successful as a manager.
Renee, I know you've got a question, and we should probably wrap up on the career coaching
side of it.
But I do want to share that working with a career coach can be incredibly powerful. My situation was 30, 35 years ago. I've learned a lot since then. And frankly, it's the part of my job I enjoy the most. And the reason is because everybody's different. What works with one member of your team won't work with the other. And that can be fun. But I know a big part of your business, in fact, I think you help here at KPCW on some of our HR stuff as well, and we should probably disclose that. Renee, I know you've got some questions.
Yeah, when we talk about the star performer, I think one of the things that's surprising to them is they're just a really self-motivated employee, and when they get into management, it's a shock to realize that not every employee is self-motivated. And that leads to my next question. As a new business owner or a small business owner, you're so passionate about your business, right? You're doing what you love, and you start hiring people, and suddenly you realize, oh, they don't share my passion. They're here because they want a paycheck. What are some of the things that a new business owner or a small business owner should be checking off the HR list when they get started?
Sure. I love that. Well, I would say a lot of this flows over from the career coaching piece, is just finding what drives people, what motivates them, a little bit about them. In HR, there's that fine line of learning about them personally, but not, you don't want to know too much for everyone's benefit, I would say, but you have to know something about them to know what drives them and to know those things, just like you're saying. Okay, someone might on the surface maybe look like somebody who, what I call, doesn't have a sense of urgency, whereas they're really driven by these other factors and finding out what those are. For example, maybe flexibility. Maybe they say, gosh, you know, these people can really, they take a project and they complete it, no problem. But what I need to give them is a little bit of flexibility on either the how or kind of the when they complete that project.
Now, we've got employment laws, federal employment laws. So what are a few key areas that managers and business owners need to be aware of to make sure they're in compliance with these laws?
That's a great question. So on top of everything, when you talk about employment law, is consistency. So whether a law applies to you, for example, FMLA, a lot of employers are gray on A, what is that? And B, does it even apply to me? And so that would be based on number of employees. So with that said, one piece that is typically an issue is leaves and how they are administered when you don't have to give FMLA. A lot of people say, well, we've just been giving leaves. We give them when needed.
FMLA, for our audience, is Family Medical Leave Act?
Yes, correct. Family Medical Leaves of Absence.
Put in place under the Clinton administration, I believe?
I think so, in the 90s, yeah.
Yeah, it's been around for, in a good way, it's been in place for a while, and it's a fantastic law, but that law in itself has so many ins and outs, and people just misunderstand a lot of how it's read. But above all, consistency. So if you put something in place that perhaps you don't have to do, such as maybe non-FMLA leaves, as I call them, just making sure that you're consistent and understanding kind of what that means. You don't have to, you know, offer it to certain people for certain reasons. Just look and see how you're administering it across your employee group.
One very smart HR director that I was so lucky to work with once told me this pearl of wisdom, which was, fair does not always mean equal. And so when an employee comes to you and says, well, so-and-so got XYZ, but I'm only getting XY, that's not fair. I mean, it was the first thing I'd say, fair is not always equal. And it's hard when you are managing employees. And in my past life, I have managed 82 people in a newsroom where things are going fast and furious. And having a strong HR director who was there to help with that consistent messaging, it was a safe place for both myself and my employees. And I just can't stress again how important it is to have that really good HR person in place for everybody in the business. They're not the voice of the manager. They're also the voice of the employee to the manager if they're doing a really good job. So what makes you different than other HR consultants out there?
Thank you. So I speak fluent Spanish, which I think is probably one of the biggest differentiators. I do everything in Spanish as well. So that's probably the biggest thing. Second of all, I just believe HR doesn't have to be the police. HR can be a partner, someone who you trust and can enjoy working with and be able to explain the why behind things. A lot of HR is just, this is what needs to be done, and nobody ever explains or educates.
So I noticed you've got three areas of specialization. You've got the hospitality industry, you've got technology, and you also have health sciences. There's a lot of businesses in the hospitality business here. Give us an example, without mentioning names, of maybe a situation that you've been able to help somebody in the hospitality industry navigate through.
Great. Thank you. So one, it was a great experience. I've gotten to use my Spanish a lot in the hospitality HR world. A lot of the housekeeping teams, just by nature, are of the Hispanic population, and we find a lot of them want to attend some of the same events. And it's great. They're very familial. And what I've had to navigate was kind of what you were saying, Renee, is here's how it's going to work when half the department wants to be out for one event. Treating people fairly and equitably, but helping them understand this is why, kind of going into the manager piece, why a manager might have to push back and say no for the right reasons, saying yes to others. So and really with any group, when a subset of a department all wants time off at the same time, that's a big area that I've helped with, helping understand, again, going back to the why, and then helping them tick down the layers of who should get the time off and, again, why that is. So helping with consistency within the hospitality industry is huge because they have high seasons, they have low seasons, and it just doesn't work to tell people you can't take time off in the winter. It's just doesn't work. That's really what a lot of departments like to do. But
I just had an aha moment as you were talking about that. You know, here we are, the hospitality business, our busiest season are the holidays, and that's when everybody wants to be off. So to set that expectation when you're hiring somebody and say, you know, just be, you're working Christmas, you know, that could probably save a lot of agita down the road, but still, that's got to be tough for a lot of the hospitality employers around here. Any other specific examples you can give us about how you have helped a local business? I know that you did present to the nonprofits. Are you working with some nonprofits right now?
I am, yes. And that actually, the model of instituting an HR administrative person within their company has worked out really well. One I work with is right around 75 employees. And so having an HR administrative person, because the reality is HR is very administrative, but then when you need those higher level items, and I find probably once a month we're talking about something that comes up a little bit out of their realm.
So when you mean administrative, you mean like the payroll and the benefits and those administrative items. But when it comes to a management issue, like a disciplinary issue or something like that, that's where you can come in and help navigate those kind of more difficult waters.
Absolutely.
I know we need to wrap, but I want to circle back to a point that Renee made earlier about the HR director that you had worked with previously. And one of the things you said made that person so powerful was they were not only a member of the management team, but they were also an advocate for the employees. I think a lot of employees don't know that the HR director can be an advocate for them. Can you talk to us about that? Because I think it's important that the public knows that.
Absolutely. And that's a question I get a lot of the time with employees. They say, why aren't you getting my back more? Why aren't you, when I was within companies, you're my advocate? And I think the real value that HR can show is being a strategy member of the team and helping understand where the company's going. But also, it's a tricky balance, but helping the employees to feel like they're supported at the same time. And I think that, well, I know that goes back to the right words. And I refer to them as culture words. You can't just pick your culture. You have to decide what words you're going to use, how you're going to act. For example, with an employee, a lot of times people say, can we just make this off the record? And right up front, and like managers too, training them to say, gosh, you know, I really care about what you're going to say, but before we get into this conversation, I just want to be upfront about what this means when you say you want it to be off the record. I have responsibilities, and these are what they are. So that balance is key, and it's
that
off.
Right there is it probably saved, is going to save one of our listeners a huge hassle in the future. That's a great point. Thank you.
And I also, just referring back to one piece too, I mentioned when I speak Spanish, sometimes it's just a matter of being able to offer a different language in HR and speaking literally a different language, but also when I say culture words, even just within that, different cultures and languages. And I think that's really important to help with that within companies.
An HR person also really, helps a manager with that difficult but imperative candor part of it. And a friend of mine just gave me the book Radical Candor, How to Manage People Without Losing Your Humanity, which I have not cracked open the book, but just the title alone intrigues me because I think a lot of managers feel like it is tough. They don't want to be the bad guy, right? Especially in a small business. And sometimes you just have to be radically candid. Thank you. Candid with your employee and to say your performance is not up to par and it's hurting the team. You know, it's for whatever reason, we've got to figure out how to fix this. And I've always found when you phrase it in terms of the team, you see the light bulb go off with the employee and they're like, okay, because, you know, they might not like me as the boss, but they do care about their teammates. And that's where I think you help getting to a satisfactory conclusion on what's the best path to go with that employee. But we don't have our next guest, I don't think. Nope. I think Ethel just shook her head. So we can go a little further in this conversation, Doug, about HR. Jill, any points that you want to make to our listeners?
Well, Renee, you just said something that I would love to call out when you said we're going to be radically candid and honest. There's a fine line, like you say, with what you can say, but you said we're going to start with your performance. And that when people say, oh, well, I have this issue and this issue, my question, my pushback is, how does this relate to their performance?
Right.
And if they can't articulate something, I can help kind of tick through, ask the right questions, but it's performance. Everything should go back to performance because that's really what we're watching on TV.
Focus on the product, not the person. So how does your performance affect the product? Not, you know, it made somebody feel bad. Well, then you get into personalities and that just gets so tangled and difficult to work out.
What are a couple other major areas that are pitfalls that you see in the HR department?
Well, I referenced consistency, lack of consistency of managers treatment of employees. So one thing that was mentioned earlier too is, you know, things aren't always going to be the same when they're done the right way, treating all employees the same way. So not being, another term I like to use is being held hostage by thinking, well, I shouldn't treat this person this way because I understand these things called protected classes, and helping them understand, well, what does that mean? And like you say, I like to throw out one example, which is very applicable because it's a lot of tech industries. The nature of the people that they hire are a certain subset. And they say, can I hire all people within, you know, say under the age of 40 in this, you know, certain nationality? And I say, sure, if it's for the right reasons. Again, hiring the right people, understanding that you don't have to hire a certain person.
So I want to clarify, because that answer surprised me. It is okay for them to say, I want to hire somebody under 40?
So not specifically that way, but thank you for clarifying. I should say, so in the tech industries, you find a lot of, let's just say, white males under the age of 40. And some people say, gosh, you know, how is that okay? Is that okay? And my response is, maybe. Are these the most qualified? And what I mean by that is, do you have a standard set of interview questions? Are you asking everyone the same thing? And then are you logging why you're not bringing on a certain person that may be outside of that group? Now, if your group ends up being that subset of people, think about diversity for the reasons of different ideas. Again, making it a little more diverse workforce, but hire the right people for the right reasons who can do the job, qualified people.
And let's talk about one of the more challenging parts of managing. Unfortunately, not everybody is always a match for the team, and sometimes you need to part ways and let them pursue their career in a way that's going to benefit them and allow them to thrive and succeed. I'm going to give you a two-part question here. Give us some advice for managers when they do have to let somebody go. And obviously for the employee, being let go is very painful. What What should the second part of the question, what should the employee know that might be going through this situation to ease that situation for them?
Great. So to address the first part, when a manager has to let someone go, so as far as looking at the issues from performance, that's the starting place. And the reality is sometimes it gets to a place where they need to move on. I always say, first thing to say is thank you for your work. They did work for you. And I will get pushback often saying, well, their work wasn't good. I'm not going to thank them. Yes, you will thank them. Did they come into the office? Did they do? So there's, in my mind, part of it. That's how we're human. Let's keep the human in human resources. And as the employee, they are not owed a reason why. Now the reality is, would you or I really be comfortable leaving an employer not having some idea of why I was let go? That's the right thing to do. And it also will prevent somebody creating a stir in this small town we live in. So again, thanking them for their work and giving them, I love the number three, 1 to 3 reasons, solid reasons that you have discussed before. It should never be a surprise. You should never have someone lean back in their chair and say, wow, I did not see this coming. Whether it be a one-time event, some sort of violence or some sort of outburst that is clearly unacceptable, or events leading up to it that were clearly outlined. It goes back to expectations. Set expectations, set them early on, have good job descriptions. Now, this probably seems like a lot to maybe a small business thinking, oh my gosh, we haven't set clear expectations, we don't have job descriptions. What I can help with is really breaking that down and kind of triaging it. What I say is, here's your most urgent areas to look at. And it goes back to culture words, too. What are you saying to someone when you're disciplining them? And what are you saying when you're parting ways?
But if someone says, hey, Utah's a right-to-work state, I can just fire anybody I want to. I don't have to give them a reason. What are the pitfalls that go along with that line of thinking?
Yes, that is probably one of my most common questions in kind of networking conversations or just meeting someone saying, oh, I do HR. And they say, can I just ask you what this at-will piece is? So your comments are right in that this is an at-will state. Now, that's a lucky thing for us because ultimately, if someone has worked for you within a short amount of time and there's a lot of issues, I call them layered issues going on, it can be, in my mind, a supporting reason to let them go. But I firmly believe that what I consider best practice is still having some reasons where it is an at-will state, and technically you can let someone go for any reason at any time, or they can also leave at any reason for any time. But it's just like the employee, we ask for 2 weeks notice a lot of times just out of courtesy. They don't have to. Same with the employer. I say, in my mind, establish yourself as a good small employer and give some reasons why.
Not to mention the impact that has on the rest of the staff when they think somebody's been treated unfairly. That just creates a bad juju in the workplace that you just don't want out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I like your point about thanking them for their work, and I just want to build on that. Having now been on the management side of the table for many, many years, you know, when it's a difficult situation like that, I think you really want to set a goal where that person can leave with their respect intact, feeling they've been dealt with fairly and respectfully. And I love that comment, and I think it's important to share stuff like that because it's just another day in your job, but for that person, you've just turned their world upside down.
Mm-hmm. Jill, let's talk about how our listeners can reach out to you and find you with their own questions.
Perfect. My website, expeditionhr.com, and that outlines some of the key areas where I can help, but also you can reach me at jill@expeditionhr.com or by phone, 435-640-8733.
And we'll make sure we link to your website from our website, kpcw.org. We will have this segment on our website a little later today. So if someone came in about halfway through our conversation and wants to hear more of Jill's wisdom about HR, go to kpcw.org as well. Jill Schroyer, thank you so much for being here with us. We really appreciate it. We got more time with you, fortunately. We're sad to say Judy's Donuts did not make it in studio with us today. We'll try to get them back on at some point on a future Monday, so stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, Jill, thanks for filling the time with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks. I had a blast. I love educating.
We're going to take a quick underwriting break, and then Mountain Money will be right back.
Hot Tuna Acoustic Duo takes the Egyptian Theater stage June 27th through the 29th with reduced price tickets Thursday and Friday. Living legends Jorma Konkanen and Jack Cassidy, forming members of Jefferson Airplane, bring their bluesy fusion of rock, free rhythmic techniques, and a collected timber of instruments to our intimate stage. Tickets and information at Park City Shows or the box office at 649-9371. Egyptian Theater is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
This is Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender for Mountain West Bank, sponsor of the amazing programming on KPCW. At Mountain West Bank, we offer consumer loan options as well as home loans and business loans in one location. Mountain West Bank, just off Kearns, next to the theaters. MountainWestBank.com, division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hi, I'm Claudia McMullen, founder of Hugo Coffee Roasters. At Hugo Coffee, we love two things, coffee and dogs, and not necessarily in that order. Part of Hugo Coffee's mission is to save rescue animals in our community. That's why we love sponsoring the Pause for Life Adoptable Moment during the KPCW Classified Show. Hugo Coffee, saving dogs one cup at a time.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. What a fun show. And we'd like to thank our guests and also thank our great sponsors. We couldn't do a show like Mountain Money without these sponsors. And they include Mountain West Bank, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Park City Chamber Bureau, Columbus Pacific Development with Pendry and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
And a big thank you to our guests for giving us their time this morning. We kicked off the hour with Jason Ware. He works with you, Doug. He's the Chief Investment Officer at Albion Financial Group. And then we just wrapped up with Jill Schroyer. She's with Expedition HR. Some great thoughts there on human resource management in your company, whether big or small, and even career coaching if you're just looking for that. So let's see. It's about 10 o'clock at the top of the hour. We've got some blue skies out here. It looks like it's going to be sunny throughout the week, Doug. And let's talk a little bit about next Monday. You and Roger are going to have a really interesting guest.
Yeah, as I mentioned during the show, it is a gentleman that actually came up with the theory of the inverted yield curve. And as Jason said, it's been a very predictive tool. That doesn't mean it's going to be predictive in the future, but I'm very interested to have that conversation.
Yeah, the inverted yield curve. He's a professor, and I'm sorry I don't have his name, but Roger Goldman's very excited about talking to him. I know you are too, Doug. And again, I love what Jason Ware said. To be an investor, you have to be a believer in a better tomorrow. I think that's who we are here at Mountain Money.
Optimism. Yeah, optimism is so important in many.